Hello, and welcome to Silver Threads, a weekly program of information on how you can make your senior year shine. I'm Kathy Van Skoik. I am not often left speechless, but the article that I'm reading today brought me very close. The title, How the Elderly Lose Their Rights, while being, I think, quite distressing to begin with, doesn't begin to express the reality of the abuse that is reported in the October 9, 2017 issue of The New Yorker. I'm calling the program Guardianship Atrocities. The article exposes a racket wherein legally appointed guardians can sell the assets and control the lives of senior citizens without their consent and reap profit from it. As the article by Rachel Aviv is quite long, I will read part one today and part two next week, How the Elderly Lose Their Rights. For years, Rudy North woke up at 9 a.m. and read the Las Vegas Review-Journal while eating a piece of toast. Then he read a novel. He liked James Patterson and Clive Cussler. Or, if he was feeling more ambitious, Freud. On scraps of paper and legal notepads, he jotted down thoughts sparked by his reading. Deep below the rational part of our brain is an underground ocean where strange things swim, he wrote on one notepad. On another, life, the longer it cooks, the better it tastes. Rennie, his wife of 57 years, was slower to rise. She was recovering from lymphoma and suffered from neuropathy so severe that her legs felt like sausages. Each morning, she spent nearly an hour in the bathroom applying makeup and lotions, the same brands she'd used for 40 years. She always emerged wearing pale pink lipstick. Rudy, who was prone to grandiosity, liked to refer to her as my amour. On the Friday before Labor Day, 2013, the Norths had just finished their toast when a nurse, who visited five times a week to help Rennie bathe and dress, came to their house in Sun City Aliente, an active adult community in Las Vegas. They had moved there in 2005 when Rudy, a retired consultant for broadcasters, was 68 and Rennie was 66. They took pride in their view of the golf course, though neither of them played golf. Rudy chatted with the nurse in the kitchen for 20 minutes, joking about marriage and laundry, until there was a knock at the door. A stocky woman with shiny black hair introduced herself as April Parks, the owner of the company, a private professional guardian. She was accompanied by three colleagues who didn't give their names. Parks told the Norths that she had an order from the Clark County Family Court to remove them from their home. She would be taking them to an assisted living facility. Go and gather your things, she said. Rennie began crying. This is my home, she said. One of Parks' colleagues said that if the Norths didn't comply, he would call the police. Rudy remembers thinking, you're going to put my wife and me in jail for this? But he felt too confused to argue. Parks drove a Pontiac G6 convertible with a license plate that read CRTGRDN for Court Guardian. In the past 12 years, she had been a guardian for some 400 wards of the court. Owing to age or disability, they had been deemed incompetent, a legal term that describes those who are unable to make reasoned choices about their lives or their property. As their guardian, Parks had the authority to manage their assets and to choose where they lived, whom they associated with, and what medical treatment they received. They lost nearly all their civil rights. Without realizing it, the Norths had become temporary wards of the court. Parks had filed an emergency ex parte petition, which provides an exception to the rule that both parties must be notified of any argument before a judge. She had alleged that the Norths posed a substantial risk for the mismanagement of medication, financial loss, and physical harm. She submitted a brief letter from a physician's assistant, whom Rennie had seen once, stating that the patient's husband can no longer effectively take care of the patient at home as his dementia is progressing. She also submitted a letter from one of Rudy's doctors, who described him as confused and agitated. Rudy and Rennie had not undergone any cognitive assessments. They never received a diagnosis of dementia. In addition to Freud, Rudy was working his way through Nietzsche and Plato. Rennie read romance novels. Parks told the nurse that if they didn't comply willingly, an ambulance would take them to the facility, a place she described as a respite. Still crying, Rennie put cosmetics and some clothes into a suitcase. She packed so quickly that she forgot her cell phone and Rudy's hearing aid. After 35 minutes, Park's assistant led the nurse to her car. When a neighbor asked what was happening, Rudy told him, "Oh, we'll just be gone for a little bit." He was too proud to draw attention to their predicament. "Just think of it as a mini vacation," he told Rennie. After the nurse left, Parks walked through the house with Cindy Breck, the owner of Caring Transitions, a company that relocates seniors and sells their belongings at estate sales. Breck and Parks had a routine. "We open drawers," Parks said at a deposition. "We look in closets, we pull out boxes, anything that would store, that would keep paperwork, would keep valuables." She took a pocket watch, birth certificates, insurance policies, and several collectible coins. The nurse's daughter, Julie Belshi, came to visit later that afternoon. A 53-year-old mother of three sons, she and her husband run a small business designing and constructing pools. She lived 10 miles away and visited her parents nearly every day, often taking them to her youngest son's football games. She was her parents' only living child. Her brother and sister had died. She knocked on the front door several times and then tried to push the door open, but it was locked. She was surprised to see the kitchen window closed. Her parents always left it slightly open. She drove to the Sun City Oriente clubhouse, where her parents sometimes drank coffee. When she couldn't find them there, she thought that perhaps they'd gone on an errand together. The farthest they usually drove was to Costco, but when she returned to the house, it was still empty. That weekend, she called her parents several times. She also called two hospitals to see if they had been in an accident. She called their landlord, too, and he agreed to visit the house. He reported that there were no signs of them. She told her husband, "I think someone kidnapped my parents." On the Tuesday after Labor Day, she drove to the house again and found a note taped to the door. "In case of emergency, contact guardian April Parks." Belshi dialed the number. Parks, who had a brisk, girlish way of speaking, told Belshi that her parents had been taken to Lakeview Terrace, an assisted living facility in Boulder City, 9 miles from the Arizona border. She assured Belshi that the staff there would take all of their needs into consideration. "You can't just walk into somebody's home and take them," Belshi told her. Parks responded calmly, "It's legal." Guardianship derives from the state's parens patriae power, its duty to act as a parent for those considered too vulnerable to care for themselves. "The king shall have custody of the lands of natural fools, taking the profits of them without waste or destruction, and shall find them their necessaries," reads the English statute De Prerogative Regis from 1324. The law was imported to the colonies. Guardianship is still controlled by state, not federal law, and has remained largely intact for the past 800 years. It establishes a relationship between ward and a guardian that is rooted in trust. In the United States, 1.5 million adults are under the care of guardians, either family members or professionals, who control some $273 billion in assets, according to an auditor for the Guardianship Fraud Program in Palm Beach County. Little is known about the outcome of these arrangements because states do not keep complete figures on guardianship cases. Statutes vary widely, and in most jurisdictions, the court records are sealed. A government accountability report from 2010 said, "We could not locate a single website, federal agency, state or local entity, or any other organization that compiles comprehensive information on this issue." A study published this year by the American Bar Association found that an unknown number of adults languish under guardianship when they no longer need it or never did. The authors wrote that guardianship is generally permanent, leaving no way out until death do us part. When the Norse were removed from their home, they joined nearly 9,000 adult wards in Las Vegas Valley. In the past 20 years, the city has promoted itself as a retirement paradise. Attracted by the state's low taxes and a dry, sunny climate, elderly people leave their families behind to resettle in newly constructed senior communities. The whole town sparkled, pulling older people in with the prospect of the American dream at a reasonable price, a former real estate agent named Terry Williams told me. Roughly 30% of the people who move to Las Vegas are senior citizens, and the number of Nevadans older than 85 has risen by nearly 80% in the past decade. In Nevada, as in many states, anyone can become a guardian by taking a course, as long as he or she has not been convicted of a felony or recently declared bankruptcy. Elizabeth Brickfield, a Las Vegas lawyer who has worked in guardianship law for 20 years, said that about 15 years ago, as the state's elderly population swelled, all these private guardians started arriving and the docket exploded. The court became a factory. Pamela Teaster, director of the Center for Gerontology at Virginia Tech and one of the few scholars in the country who study guardianship, told me that though most guardians assume their duties for good reasons, the guardianship system is a morass, a total mess. She said, "It's unconscionable that we don't have any data when you think about the vast power given a guardian. It's one of society's most drastic interventions." After talking to Parks, Belge drove 40 miles to Lakeview Terrace, a complex of stucco buildings designed to look like a hacienda. She found her parents in a small room with a kitchenette and a window overlooking the parking lot. Rennie was in a wheelchair beside the bed. Rudy was curled up on the love seat in the fetal position. There was no phone in the room. Medical alert buttons were strung around their necks. They were like two lost children, Belge said. She asked her parents who Parks was and where she could find the court order, but she said they were overwhelmed and humiliated and they didn't know what was going on. They had no idea how or why Parks had targeted them as wards. Belge was struck by their passive acceptance. It was like they had Stockholm syndrome or something. Belge acknowledged that her parents needed a few hours of help each day, but she had never questioned their ability to live alone. They always kept their house really nice and clean, like a museum, she said. Although Rudy's medical records showed that he occasionally had staring spells, all his medical progress notes from 2013 described him as alert and oriented. He did most of the couple's cooking and shopping because Rennie, though lucid, was in so much pain that she rarely left the house. Belge sometimes worried that her father inadvertently encouraged her mother to be docile. She's a very smart woman, though she sometimes acts like she's not. I have to tell her, that's not cute, Mom. When Belge called Parks to ask for the court order, Parks told her that she was part of the sandwich generation and that it would be too overwhelming for her to continue to care for her children and her parents at the same time. Parks billed her ward's estates for each hour that she spent on their case. The court placed no limits on guardians' fees as long as they appeared reasonable. Later, when Belge called again to express her anger, Parks charged the nurse $24 for the 8-minute conversation. I could not understand what the purpose of the call was other than she wanted me to know that they had no rights, Parks wrote in a detailed invoice, terminated the phone call as she was very hostile and angry. A month after removing the nurse from their house, Parks petitioned to make the guardianship permanent. She was represented by an attorney who was paid $400 an hour by the North's estate. A hearing was held at Clark County Family Court. The Clark County Guardianship Commissioner, a lawyer named John Norheim, has presided over nearly all of the guardianship cases in the county since 2005. He works under the supervision of a judge, but his orders have the weight of a formal ruling. Norheim awarded a guardianship to Parks, on average, nearly once a week. She had up to 100 wards at a time. I love Parks, he said at one hearing, describing her and two other professional guardians who frequently appeared in his courtroom as wonderful, good-hearted social worker types. Norheim's court perpetuated a cold, unsentimental view of family relations. The ingredients for a good life seemed to have little to do with one's children or siblings. He often dismissed the objections of relatives, telling them that his only concern was the best interest of the wards, which he seemed to view in a social vacuum. When siblings fought over who would be guardian, Norheim typically ordered a neutral professional to assume control, even when this isolated the wards from their families. Rudy had assured Belgi that he would protest the guardianship, but like most wards in the country, Rudy and Rennie were not represented by counsel. As Rudy stood before the commissioner, he convinced himself that guardianship offered him and Rennie a lifetime of care without being a burden to anyone they loved. He told Norheim, "The issue really is her longevity. What suits her?" Belgi, who sat in the courtroom, said, "I was shaking my head. No, 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 don't do that." But Rennie was silent. Norheim ordered that the Norths become permanent wards of the court. "Chances are I'll probably never see you folks again. You'll work everything out," he said, laughing. "I very rarely see people after the initial time in court." The hearing lasted 10 minutes. The following month, Eventide Life Transitions, a company that Parks often hired, sold most of the North's belongings. "The general condition of this inventory is good," an appraiser wrote. Two lithographs by Renoir were priced at $3,800, and a glass cocktail table, client says that it is a Brancusi design, was $1,250. The Norths also had several pastel drawings by their son, Randy, who died in a motorcycle accident at the age of 32, as well as Kachina dolls, a Bose radio, a Dyson vacuum cleaner, Peruvian tapestry, motion step exerciser, Leroy Neiman's sketch of a bar in Dublin, and 24 pairs of Clark shoes. According to Parks' calculations, the Norths had roughly $50,000. Parks transferred their savings, held at the Bank of America, to an account in her name. Rennie repeatedly asked for her son's drawings and for the family photographs on her refrigerator. Rudy pined for his car, a midnight blue 2010 Chrysler, which came to symbolize the life he had lost. He missed the routine interactions that driving had allowed him. "Everybody at the pharmacy was my buddy," he said. Now he and Rennie felt like exiles. Rudy said, "They kept telling me, 'Oh, you don't have to worry, your car is fine,' and this and that." Well, a month later, he said, "They finally told me, 'Actually, we sold your car.' I said, 'What in the hell did you sell it for?' It was bought for less than $8,000, a price that Rudy considered insulting." Rudy lingered in the dining room after eating breakfast each morning, chatting with other residents of Lakeview Terrace. He soon discovered that 10 other wards of April Parks lived there. His next-door neighbor, Adolfo Gonzalez, a short, bald 71-year-old who had worked as maitre d' at the MGM Grand Las Vegas, had become Parks' ward at a hearing that lasted a minute and 31 seconds. Gonzalez, who had roughly $350,000 in assets, urged Rudy not to accept the nurse's medications. "If you take the pills, they'll make sure you don't make it to court," said Gonzalez. He had been prescribed the antipsychotic medications Risperdal and Depakote, which he hid in the side of his mouth without swallowing. He wanted to remain vigilant. He often spoke of the Salvador Dali painting that had been lost when Parks took over his life. Once, she charged him $210 for a visit in which, according to her invoice, he expressed that he feels like a prisoner. Rudy was so distressed by his conversations with Gonzalez that he asked to see a psychologist. "I thought maybe he'd give me some sort of objective learning as to what I was going through," he said. "I wanted to ask basic questions like, what the hell's going on?" Rudy didn't find the session illuminating, but he felt a little boost to his self-esteem when the psychologist asked that he return for a second appointment. "I guess he found me terribly charming," he told me. Rudy liked to fantasize about an alternative life as a psychoanalyst, and he tried to befriend the wards who seemed especially hopeless. Loneliness is a physical pain that hurts all over, he wrote in his notebook. He bought a pharmaceutical encyclopedia and advised the other wards about medications they'd been prescribed. He also ran for president of the residents, promising that under his leadership, the kitchen would no longer advertise canned food as homemade. He lost. He's not sure if anyone besides Rennie voted for him, but he did win a seat on the residents' council. He was particularly concerned about a ward of Park's named Marlene Homer, a 70-year-old woman who had been a professor. Now she's almost hiding behind pillars, Rudy said. She's so obsequious. She was like, run me over. She'd become a ward in 2012 after Parks told the court she has admitted to strange thoughts, depression, and doing things she can't explain. On a certificate submitted to the court, an internist had checked a box indicating that Homer was unable to attend the guardianship court hearing because blank, but he didn't fill in the reason. The Norse could guess which residents were Park's wards by the way they were dressed. Gonzalez wore the same shirt to dinner nearly every day. When a friend tried to take him shopping, Parks prevented the excursion because she didn't know the friend. Rennie had also tried to get more clothes. I reminded Ward that she had plenty of clothing in her closet, Parks wrote. I let her know that they are on a tight budget. The Norse estate was charged $180 for the conversation. Another resident, Barbara Neely, a 55-year-old with schizophrenia, repeatedly asked Parks to buy her outfits for job interviews. After Neely's third week in Lakeview Terrace, Parks' assistant sent Parks a text. Can you see Barbara Neely any time this week? She wrote. She has questions on the guardianship and how she can get out of it. Parks responded, I can and she can't. Neely had been in the process of selling her house for $168,000 when Parks became her guardian and took charge of the sale. The rationale for the guardianship of Norbert Wilkening, who lived on the bottom floor of the facility in the memory care ward for people with dementia, snake pit, Rudy called it, was also murky. Parks' office manager, who advertised himself as a qualified dementia care specialist, a credential acquired through video training sessions, had given Wilkening a mini mental state examination, a list of 11 questions and tasks, including naming as many animals as possible in a minute. Wilkening had failed. His daughter, Amy, told me, I didn't see anything that was happening to him other than regular getting older process, but when I was informed by all these people that he had all these problems, I was like, well, maybe I'm just in denial. I'm not a professional. She said that Parks was so highly touted by herself, by the social workers, by the judge, by everyone that knew her. At the hearing, when Amy complained to Norheim that Parks didn't have time for her father, he replied, yeah, she's an industry at this point. As Belshi spoke to more wards and their families, she began to realize that Lakeview Terrace was not the only place where wards were lodged, and that Parks had not the only guardian removing people from their homes for what appeared to be superficial reasons. Hundreds of cases followed the same pattern. It had become routine for guardians in Clark County to petition for temporary guardianship on the ex parte basis. They told the court that they had to intervene immediately because the ward faced a medical emergency that was only vaguely described. He or she was demented or disoriented, and risk of exploitation or abuse. The guardians attached a brief physician's certificate that contained minimal details and often stated that the ward was too incapacitated to attend a court hearing. Deborah Bookout, an attorney at the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada, told me, when a hospital or rehab facility needs to free up a bed, or when the patient is not paying his bills, some doctors get sloppy and they will sign anything. A recent study conducted by Hunter College found that a quarter of guardianship petitions in New York were brought by nursing homes and hospitals, sometimes as a means of collecting overdue bills. It often took several days for relatives to realize what had happened. When they tried to contest the guardianship or become guardians themselves, they were dismissed as unsuitable and disparaged in court records as being neglectful or as drug addicts, gamblers, and exploiters. Belshi was described by Parks as a reported addict who had no contact with the proposed ward, an allegation that Belshi didn't see until it was too late to challenge. Family who lived out of state were disqualified from serving as guardians because the law prohibited the appointment of anyone who didn't live in Nevada. Once the court approved the guardianship, the wards were often removed from their homes, which were eventually sold. Terry Williams, whose father's estate was taken over by strangers even though he had named her the executor of his will, has spent years combing through guardianship, probate, and real estate records in Clark County. I kept researching because I was so fascinated that these people could literally take over the lives and assets of people under color of law in less than 10 minutes, and nobody was asking questions, she told me. These people spent their lives accumulating wealth, and in the blink of an eye, it was someone else's. Williams has reviewed hundreds of cases involving Jared Schaefer, who is considered the godfather of guardians in Nevada. In the records room of the courthouse, she was afraid to say Schaefer's name out loud. In the course of his 35-year career, Schaefer has assumed control of more than 3,000 wards and estates and trained a generation of guardians. In 1979, he became the country's public administrator, handling the estates of people who had no relatives in Nevada, as well as the public guardian, serving wards when no family members or private guardians were available. In 2003, he left government and founded his own private guardianship and fiduciary business. He transferred the number of his government-issued phone to himself. Williams took records from Schaefer's and other guardians' cases to the Las Vegas Police Department several times. She tried to explain, she said, that this is a racketeering operation that is fee-based. There's no brown paper bag handed off in an alley. The payoff is the right to build the estate. The department repeatedly told her that it was a civil issue and refused to take a report. In 2006, she submitted a typed statement listing 23 statutes that she thought had been violated, but an officer wrote in the top right corner, "Not a police matter." Adam Woodrum, an estate lawyer in Las Vegas, told me that he's worked with several wards and their families who have brought their complaints to the police. "They can't even get their foot in the door," he said. Acting as her own attorney, Williams filed a racketeering suit in federal court against Schaefer and the lawyers who represented him. At a hearing before the United States District Court of Central California in 2009, she told the judge, "They are trumping up ways and means to deem people incompetent and take their assets." The case was dismissed. "The scheme is ingenious," she told me. "How do you come up with a crime that literally none of the victims can articulate without sounding like they're nuts? The same insane allegations keep surfacing from people who don't know each other." And that's only half of the appalling story. I will continue the article next week. Thanks for listening. And until next week, I'm Kathy Van Skoik. You've been listening to Silver Threads, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. The audio producer for the show is Maureen Rich, and I'm Kathy Van Skoik. I hope you'll join me again next week for more information and updates for making the best of your silver years. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.